Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, interesting report from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. CMS reported that healthcare spending held at the modest rate of 3.6% growth in 2013. That's the lowest rate of increases since 1960, when CMS kept records on this rate of inflation.
Spending indeed slowed across a number of areas: private health insurance, Medicare, hospitals, physicians and clinical services, and out-of-pocket spending by consumers, which I think might be the key to all the other ones.
Analysts are looking at those numbers and the causes for them, including the recession and changes in spending for things like Medicare due to the Affordable Care Act.
As more Americans rely on high-deductible insurance plans, one in three American families report that they have put off seeking medical attention due to out-of-pocket costs, and that's got to have an impact on spending as well.
Analysts say now that the economy is improving, that might send healthcare spending higher in the coming years. Also, the market is shifting so dramatically, with millions of Americans now buying health insurance on online markets, and it's not so clear yet how those things will affect healthcare spending moving forward.
Well, we spent $2.9 trillion on healthcare in 2013. That was roughly 18% of the national GDP. And at least when we look comparatively at other developed countries, that's too big a chunk of the economy.
The cost of medical education is also rather high in this country, and the cost of training one physician can run into millions. It's making health policy officials rethink new approaches to filling the gaps in healthcare workforce using some creative ideas.
Well, that is something that our guest today is quite informed about. Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen is a pediatrician, writer, health policy expert, also an expert on graduate medical education and training in this country, and has some insights into what kinds of changes might be called for and how best to prepare the healthcare workforce of the future.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at more false claims spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, at CHC Radio. We'd love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. What a difference a healthcare law makes. In the past 5 years, the Department of Health and Human Services has become the third largest payer to outside contractors after the defense industry dominated the space for decades. While automatic spending cuts and a shrinking military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan have led to some sharp declines in defense spending on private contractors, conversely, the Affordable Care Act has led to increased government spending on health-related contractors. Health spending from HHS has increased 147%. Since 2009. Change in the wind at the Office of National Coordinator for Health IT. ONC is emphasizing two directions: continued momentum in adoption of EHR technology and better interface of that data as well. 94% of eligible hospitals and close to 80% of eligible physicians have received payment for either purchasing or meaningfully using a tested certified EHR. But the program left gaps by not extending payments to behavioral health, long-term care, and other providers. The ONC and other federal agencies are looking at ways to help these excluded providers cover the cost of buying electronic health records. Giving birth in America, fewer women are heading down the maternity road. Statistics show a six-year decline in birth rates in this country. In 2013, there were 3.93 million births, down 9% from the high in 2007. The economy is largely to blame. And a recent analysis of the significant decline in teen births has been attributed in part, according to a study, to the reality show 16 and Pregnant, which depicts the lives of teen mothers and the struggles they face daily to stay in school while caring for a child. The study showed a dramatic uptick in Google searches for things like birth control, which spiked nationally every time an episode aired, the reality of watching their peers struggle with loss of freedom, abandonment by the baby's fathers, and challenges involved with raising a child, really sending that message home. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. Dr. Mullen is also Professor of Pediatrics at the George Washington School of Medicine. Dr. Mullen served as Assistant U.S. Surgeon General, was the Director of the National Health Service Corps, and is a member of the Council of Graduate Medical Education, an editor at Health Affairs. He's written numerous articles and books on the subject of healthcare, including White Coat, Clenched Fist. Dr. Mullen, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been 4 years since you've been on our show, and much has changed in the healthcare landscape. And, you know, at last count, some 10 million uninsured Americans have gained coverage, and we're on track, hopefully, for millions more in this second round of open enrollment. But much of your career has been focused in on closing the health disparity. So could you illustrate for our listeners the fundamental importance of giving millions of previously uninsured Americans access to health care? And what's the potential impact of that one fundamental change of access in the nation's health policy?
Well, once upon a time, the year 1900, it probably didn't matter if you had access to health care. In fact, you may have suffered ill effects in the hands of physicians. As the 20th century progressed, medical science improved, antibiotics were invented, diagnostic tools such as x-rays came along, and it did matter whether you had health care. And people without money had to rely on charity care of some sort, which was in short supply. By the mid-20th century, we had health insurance that stepped in as a vehicle to allow people and their employers to put money aside so that when they got sick, they had access. In 1965, Medicare was enacted because old people didn't work and didn't have coverage. The government stepped in and provided what has become a very popular program. It also provided Medicaid, or also enacted Medicaid at that time, which has been a spotty effort to cover the poor. Every state runs it differently. Levels of eligibility vary. And that's where we found ourselves at the beginning of the 21st century, with some 40 or 50 million Americans, about 15% of the population, without access to the healthcare system. And the Affordable Care Act has been a principled effort to get at that. It's a complicated issue to begin with the terrible fractiousness in general, and Republicans by and large not subscribing to the notion that there was a public role in trying to assure access for those who weren't covered. It adopted health insurance, which is not a terribly efficient way to provide access, but that was one of the compromises needed to be made. And we have the bill that we have before us, which is a huge step ahead morally, and it's a huge step in terms of beginning to fill in the system. But it's made considerable progress, and we know that there are millions of folks now who are covered who wouldn't be, and more to come. And it's only as more people get on over a period of time that we'll be able to measure the full impact. And in fact, I believe in many that the full impact will be greatly appreciated by the population as a whole, and you will have a huge constituency for what will then be looked back on, I suppose, as Obamacare. And I think it will be as popular as Medicare a few years down the road.
Well, Fitzhugh, as often as we talked about bringing millions of people into the ranks of the insured, we also talked about and who will take care of these individuals. And so the whole question of the capacity of the primary care provider and the health profession workforce generally was huge. And you've commented on this question of, is there a shortfall of primary care providers, and the degree to which our way of training future physicians, in particular through graduate medical education, might have to be adjusted. Of course, the Institute of Medicine just released its report on graduate medical education and called for the establishment of a transformation fund, which might look at, can we do some things in a new way? So maybe you could comment on that area for us.
Surely, Margaret. There are really two questions there. One is the question of adequacy. Do we have a shortage, and where are we headed in terms of numbers of providers? And the second is, since for medicine, for medical practitioners, graduate medical education is the final common pathway into practice. U.S. medical school graduates are joined by U.S. osteopathic school graduates, who are joined by international medical graduates, and then international medical graduates who are non-U.S. citizens. So all of those candidates for practice come together in GME, graduate medical education, because in order to get a license, you need to have graduate medical education. So how we manage and fund and subsidize graduate medical education is terribly important, which is why that report is long overdue and very welcome. So the first question, shortage. So there's a fair amount of flexibility in the system, and a lot of what happens is local convention. Primary care is the bedrock of a system. That needs to be robust, and all kinds of studies have demonstrated this in terms of outcomes, in terms of costs, and in terms of patient satisfaction. The more robust the primary care situation is in a community, the better the outcomes in general, the lower the costs, and the higher the patient satisfaction will be. In practice, primary care physicians make roughly half on average as specialists do. And their work lives are generally less controllable than certain specialties. So we have a long-standing, unlevel playing field in this country of primary care and then what students, medical students, choose. That problem is with us. We are definitely short, and we'll be shorter as we have more people arriving in the system. But is the system as a whole short? And the answer is probably not. More people will be insured under the Affordable Care Act. And as we are an aging population, our demographics are moving to the elderly, who clearly consume more health services, including, importantly, primary care, which can sort out the problems of the elderly more effectively than sending everybody to a cartload of specialists. Does that mean we need to put a lot more doctors into the field? My own thought is we need to grow as the population grows, but we have good evidence that putting doctors in does not necessarily distribute them better. The notion that if you graduate more, they will distribute to areas of the country that are in shortage, we have good evidence they don't distribute well. They tend to well up in the already well-served areas. So if we have shortage problems, the first answer is not, or many people, the first answer, oh, just put more doctors out. Mm-hmm. And they tend to stay, as many of us would, in areas where the living's easier, and that's where there's money. Secondly, as things get tighter, we need other solutions. The doctor solution is an expensive one. Other solutions, calling on our creativity, whether it's minute clinics at one end or nurse practitioners and PAs at another, there are many other ways to deal with an increasing demand. And simply using the model that we have now, and I'll call the 20th century model, it tends to use a lot of subspecialists, and that's one of the major reasons we are an outlier in the world in terms of the enormous amount that we pour into our system without terribly good results. The 21st century, you need to think through that and work through that, and a tightness in the system will lead to creativity, and what you're seeing now, particularly with the ACA, are an enormous burgeoning of other solutions or other approaches, ranging from accountable care organizations, great emphasis on population health, much more emphasis on data use, early intervention, the use of other providers such as nurse practitioners and PAs. So there are many ways to treat this issue, to skin this cat. And the old way, which is to simply pour more doctors on it, many of us feel will be very expensive and not very effective. And our job, the job of the IOM report, was to talk about how you manage this GME system, addressing the new kinds of competencies and the new kinds of locations where our doctors need to work. And they propose a transition plan that is transformative in nature and really is the first comprehensive alternative to the current plan that has been put forth. And finally, and unfortunately, the leadership group in the medical education community is very much wed to the current system, which is quite remunerative to particularly leading large teaching hospitals, and has been reluctant to take seriously this question of transformation.
We're speaking today with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. He's was the Assistant U.S. Surgeon General and served as Director of the National Health Service Corps. You know, I think yours was maybe in Mississippi. You certainly brought you face-to-face with huge disparities faced by Americans in terms of access to care. And the Affordable Care Act is putting a number of measures in place at addressing such disparities in access, as well as trying to build a more diverse workforce. Can you talk to our listeners about some of those measures in the ACA aimed at impacting the workforce diversity?
The ACA puts a great deal more money into the National Health Service Corps. There are now about 10,000 health professionals in the field in shortage areas, complements of the National Health Service Corps. And that's good. That's double the size it was previously. But that sunsets at the latter part of this year, and it isn't clear the Congress is going to re-up anything near the level of support that currently is there, a huge problem. Secondly, community health centers, the federally qualified health centers, the core of the safety net ambulatory system in this country. And again, it got a big bump up, and that sunsets, and it's unclear what's happening there. There are modest investments in Medicare payments, increasing primary care pay a bit. Those are the provisions. There's one important one that also sunsets, teaching health centers, where there are now 60 community-based organizations that have applied for and won grants to do residency training. These residents train at local hospitals, but their primary identity and their primary clinical training site is a community-based organization, and they're learning medicine from a non-hospital perspective while working and getting their clinical skills in local hospitals. This changes the paradigm a bit, and that's been a very good experiment. So the ACA has put ideas on the table in terms of developing the workforce, but those are less than we might have, and most of them are at risk as the ACA goes forward.
I know that your connection to the community health center movement has stayed strong over the years, and I've had the pleasure of visiting the Upper Cordoza Community Health Center. I know that you worked there as a pediatrician for many years and certainly represent not just access to care, but innovation in care, in serving a population that is overwhelmingly lower income, members of racial and ethnic minority groups. And this idea of the community health centers as a locus of innovation in the redesign of healthcare is something near and dear to our hearts. I wonder if you might want to just take a moment to talk about some of the key innovations that you see either arising out of the health centers or being adopted by the health centers and then taken to scale.
Well, health centers have long had a mandate. They sit in communities, and by definition and by law, they are community institutions. They are required to have community boards. They are required to serve all, regardless of ability to pay. So they are dealing with populations who have a community sense, often are disadvantaged in the sense of being poor, and this notion of community-oriented primary care delivery, which has been a kind of hypothesis, they've actually been practicing. In today's policy discussions, this notion of population health, of trying to prevent illness from deteriorating, is very much at the center of the debate about how do we modernize and make our system more effective, both in preventing illness from a system point of view. And health centers have been out there struggling with that for a long time when nobody was even talking about it. Community-based training really has been very much of a sidebar of our standard system, back to this notion of a teaching health center. All doctors are hospitalized in their training. They spend most of their working hours, most of their educational hours in large institutions. But most patients are ambulatory most of the time, and we seek help at doctor's offices or community clinics, and our training really does not go on there in any appreciable degree. Deinstitutionalizing training, particularly for primary care docs, but for others as well, surgeons, the operating room is their big tool, but more and more ambulatory surgery is being done. So the push to develop teaching and training and role modeling in communities is very important. So it's very hard to move that, some of it, out into the community. Community health centers are really pioneering a new kind of training that will certainly put new competencies and new values into the practice of medicine, nursing, dentistry, right through the health professions, which are more community-oriented, population-focused, hopefully economic and efficient.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. You can learn more about his work by going to publichealth.gwu.edu. Dr. Mullen, thanks so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare. Conversations on Healthcare. We want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Would President Obama's executive actions on immigration include a $3,000 bonus to employers for each immigrant they hire instead of a U.S. citizen? Not exactly. But that's what some Republicans and conservative media outlets are saying, and it has to do with the Affordable Care Act's employer penalties. Under the ACA, employers may be required to pay penalties if their employees are eligible for tax credits to purchase health insurance through the law's new marketplaces. But those who gain provisional legal status under the president's immigration plan wouldn't be eligible for the tax credits. Does that create an incentive to hire immigrants over citizens? Perhaps, but healthcare experts say it would be in rare circumstances. Employers hiring or firing based on healthcare credit eligibility would be subject to discrimination provisions in the law. Most firms wouldn't even face the potential ACA penalties because they're either too small, fewer than 50 full-time employees, or already offer health insurance, as 96% of firms with 50 or more employees do. The White House estimates that less than 0.2% of all firms could face the employer requirements. An employer could incur that $3,000 penalty if the firm offers insurance that doesn't meet minimum coverage standards or is deemed unaffordable for some employees, and an employee gets a marketplace plan with the help of tax credits. But again, immigrants affected by Obama's actions aren't eligible for the tax credits. One health law professor told us that if only a few employees qualify for the tax credits, it could be worth hiring such immigrants. But it would require some manipulation to get the math right to both incur costs for offering substandard insurance and still save money on the penalties. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's a known fact that the current generation of American children is more obese than any previous generation. And at a Washington, D.C. community health center, Unity Healthcare, a pediatrician was in a quandary over how to tackle this growing health scourge. He began with a unique solution targeted to a teen patient whose body mass index, or BMI, had already landed her in the obese category. What he did was write a prescription for getting off the bus one stop earlier on her way to school, which made her walk the equivalent of 1 mile a day. Dr. Robert Czar of Unity Community Health Center understood that without motivation to move more, kids just might not do it. The patient complied with the prescription and has moved from the obese down to the overweight category, certainly an improvement. He then decided to expand this program by working with the D.C. Parks Department, mapping out all the potential walks and play area kids have within the city's parks, mapping 380 of them so far.
How to get there? Parking. Is parking available if someone's going to drive? Bike racks. There's a section on pets. Park safety.
Dr. Czar writes park prescriptions on a special prescription pad in English and Spanish with the words RX for outdoor activity and a schedule slot that asks, when and where will you play outside this week?
I like to listen and find out what it is my patients like to do and then gauge the parks I prescribe based on their interests, based on their schedule, based on the things they're willing to do.
Ultimately, Dr. Czar says, with some 40% of his patient population grappling with overweight or obesity, he wants to make the prescription for outdoor activity adaptable for all of his patients and adaptable for pediatricians around the country. He's planning to create an app for his parks database where providers and patients alike can use it, and one day he'd like to be able to track his patients' activities in the parks. RX for outdoor activity, partnering clinicians, park administrators, patients, and their families to move more, yielding fitter, healthier young people. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.